The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So a couple of weeks ago, we had a question period. And at the end of that question period, one of you asked a question about free will. And I decided to defer that question and thinking reflections on that question until today. So that's the topic for today. Is there free will? What does this teaching have to say about free will? You know, the question of free will is an ancient philosophical question, and the discussions about free will go back several millennia in pretty much every culture. And the questions are framed in so many different ways, you know, in some ways. You know, we probably have as many definitions of free will as there are people in this room, and you know, the ways, I actually looked up this a little bit this morning on a website, a Stanford philosophy website, and they had a page of different ways that free will was expressed and thought about. And so, you know, it's hard to say, and I'm not going to try to go through all of those different ways that free will is defined. I'm going to mention two things about free will that often are kind of congealing points, and then offer some reflections about how Buddhism thinks about these, or my understanding about how the Buddhist teachings explore these particular topics. So often the question of free will is related to, do we have choice? How does choice work? Is choice determined by what's happened in the past? Do we actually have freedom of choice? That's one piece of free will. The other piece, related in a way, but kind of the other side of it, is based on how we've acted, are the consequences of that action determined? Are they set in stone? And so that's another piece of the question, or what comes up around free will. Essentially, that's the question of determinism. Based on our actions, are the consequences determined? So those are two pieces that I'll reflect on. And to me, this question comes back to what the Buddha had to say about choice and intention. And the teaching on karma. The teaching on actions and their consequences. So to begin to explore this question, I'd like to do a kind of an overview of the teaching on karma, and then explore its relationship to the question on free will and determinism. And hopefully I can do that in enough of a way to, a broad enough way, that we'll leave time for conversation at the end, because I think this is a topic that likes conversation. So I'll try to keep my comments at the broad brush level and then see where the conversation wants to deepen of those topics that I've offered. So karma. The term karma is conventionally used in our culture even, and often it's used, you know, to express, you know, the consequences of what's happened, you know, that what you're experiencing is your karma or something like that. And so it's used in a way in our own language, but there are some nuances to the word, the understanding from the perspective of Buddhism that are kind of subtler than how it's used in the everyday way in our culture. The term karma means action in it's a translation of the word action in the Pali, and in one place in the text, the Buddha is said to have said, what I call karma or what I call action is intention, because intending, we act. So this brings to mind the distinction in a way, kind of it points to a distinction between the human capacity for intending and reflecting on intentions and then acting based on those intentions, and the more perhaps more automatic processes at work in the animal realm, in at least some of the animal realm, you know, or some of the non-human realm, that choices are made based more on biology and, you know, action happens, you know, a lion is going to hunt and kill when it's hungry, you know, because that's what lions do. So the bringing it back to intention points to the fact that there is a process at work in our minds that contributes to our actions. So this is an important piece of the teaching on karma, that we have an intention that happens before every action that we do, an intention that arises before we speak, we move, or even before things happen in our minds, before we think, there's an intention to think. It's actually possible to witness this intention, and seeing this intention, seeing this kind of urge to do something, is a key point that the Buddha pointed to with mindfulness of how we can move towards freedom. Because when we are acting from our conditioned tendency, now we're kind of like the lion in a way, you know? We do what we've been conditioned to do when we're not aware of the moment of that intention leading to action. You know, we've been conditioned by our culture, by our families, by our friends, by our schools, by our communities, by television, by advertising. We've been conditioned by so much. And when we are not aware of the moment of, ooh, want that, or get rid of that, or do this, don't do that, if we're not aware of that moment, we will follow through. And so in some ways, in that moment, when we're not aware of that intention, we are not free. We are not acting from free will. We are acting from our conditioning. And so in the moment when we can see, when mindfulness can witness that intention, in that moment there's the possibility to see, oh, intending to do that. Is that a choice that leads to well-being or leads to suffering? And so another piece around this intention is that every intention is accompanied by a motivation. It's accompanied by a reason why we want to do that thing. That reason is often motivated by greed, aversion, delusion. That intention is conditioned by our past. And so there's that, you know, kind of impulse, you know, it's like we are kind of heading in a direction based on the conditioning of our past. And, you know, those motivations have a potency to them. They have a power to them. They tend to head us in the same direction that we've been in the past. And yet in the moment when we see intention, we can see, oh, is this motivation based on greed, aversion, delusion? Is this motivation based on wisdom, compassion, friendliness, kindness? And there is that moment with mindfulness that a choice can be made. When we know, when we are aware that we're making a choice, we can choose. There is a way that the mind, in the seeing of the choice, can choose between alternatives. So that's one piece around free will, in a way. And yet that choice is conditioned. So in fact, you know, so knowing that being motivated out of greed, aversion, delusion tends to head us towards suffering. Knowing that being motivated out of kindness, compassion, wisdom tends to head us towards freedom, tends to head us towards less suffering. That's information that conditions our choice. And also, I think, something about our organism participates in this too. Because, at least in my experience, the more mindful I become, It's like our system is, in a way, for most people, I would say, for the vast majority of people on this planet, our system is built to want to move away from suffering, to move away from unpleasant and towards pleasant, and is also built to be empathetic, to have an empathetic resonance with other beings. And so when we see somebody get hurt, it's like we feel that hurt ourselves. I just watched a program last night on the brain and perception, and there were a bunch of different experiments they were running on people. And one was a video of watching somebody cut themselves with a knife. And in that moment, when I saw somebody cut themselves with a knife, I felt it. I felt not the pain of the cut, but I felt a response, a kind of an automatic a response to seeing someone else in pain. And so for most of us, there is that kind of empathetic response. There are some people, some brains I understand that don't have that. But that's a kind of an illness, in a way, is my understanding. And so most of us have this empathetic response for people. And so what we begin to see is that those two pieces, the piece about moving in the direction away from suffering, away from unpleasant and towards pleasant, and the empathetic response, those two contribute together to have us input into the choices that we make. So we tend to, from the place of children, kind of automatically move towards pleasant and away from unpleasant. That's where, you know, there's less free will, in a way. You know, it's like there's the kind of automatic response to moving towards pleasant and away from unpleasant. And then as we grow, as we learn, we begin to understand certain things, like a continual movement towards pleasant can lead to unpleasant, like eating too much ice cream or, you know, something, or certain actions have a more helpful result if we wait, or if we take an action that seems counter to the immediate movement towards pleasant in this moment. So we learn what delayed gratification. And then we also begin to recognize that it's in our benefit to, and this is more in the spiritual realm, I think. We learn it's to our benefit to behave in ways in which we not only consider, is this action going to create suffering for myself, but is this action going to create suffering for others? Because we recognize that creating suffering for others, we also feel suffering. So our choices are conditioned on kind of how our being is put together. And karma is a natural law. It's understood, at least, to be a natural law, kind of like gravity is a natural law, or like genetics is a natural law. There are analogies for both in the suttas, both for gravity and for genetics, to this law of karma. So with the law of karma could be succinctly stated and is stated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Well, let me first say there are aphorisms that reflect karma. You know, we reap what we sow. That's one. You know, so when we act with intentions of anger, of frustration, we tend to get the consequences of that. At some point, we get that. We get that feedback. What goes around comes around. Another kind of aphorism that is a reflection of this understanding of karma. We know this. You know, we know this. We know this teaching. We know this law in our being. Bhikkhu Bodhi succinctly states the law of karma as, it's a kind of a complicated sentence, so I'll go over it. The capacity of our intentional actions to produce an ethically appropriate result. And so this is, you know, we reap what we sow. When our intentions, our intentional actions, are motivated from greed, from aversion, from delusion, they tend to result in unpleasant consequences, in suffering. So they head us in that direction. So, for instance, let me not go there because I want to save some time. So the capacity of our intentional actions to produce an ethically appropriate result. So our intentional actions, I talked about intentions, that intentions based on greed, aversion, and delusion tend to head us in the direction of suffering. So that's the ethically appropriate result in Buddhism. And that is the understanding of karma, is that, you know, when we act out of greed, aversion, delusion, we tend to recreate the conditions that lead us into suffering. And when we act out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, we tend to create the conditions that lead us towards freedom, away from suffering. Then there's the result of karma. So there's the action itself, the initial, the impulse, the intention and the motivation. Those are kind of in the moment. They happen in the moment. It's like if you have a soccer ball and you're kicking a soccer ball, the movement of the leg is an energetic impulse that moves the soccer ball. The energy from the leg gets transferred to the ball and the soccer ball moves. Then with respect to the results of karma, the results of that action, the consequences of that result tend to be, as I said, when we act out of greed, aversion, delusion, we tend to head in one direction. We tend to head towards suffering. We act out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, we tend to head towards freedom. And so this might be, in the soccer ball analogy, it might be like kicking the ball from the left tends to head the ball towards the right. So the direction from which the energy moves influences the direction that the soccer ball goes. So in the soccer ball analogy, there's an immediate result. There's an immediate consequence of that action. You kick the ball, it moves. With karma, the result of karma is much more uh, broad, or it's nowhere near as clear cut at times. And so when we act out of greed or aversion or delusion, we may not immediately experience the suffering or the unpleasantness that would result from that direction. In fact, we might experience the opposite. So for instance, if we have aversion and we act out of aversion, we make a choice to get rid of something that we don't like in our environment. In the moment of getting rid of it, we have a moment of pleasantness. It's like relief. Oh, I'm in control. I got that rid of that thing. So it feels good. And so it feels like it's helpful to do that. And yet the understanding is so the immediate consequence of acting on that aversion may not be obvious, especially if we're not trained to be mindful. Because we get that immediate hit of gratification. We get that immediate sense of, oh, this is helpful. I control this. I got rid of that thing that I didn't want. And yet what we've done in that moment is conditioned aversion. We have further encouraged our mind to move in the direction of aversion. And when we actually start to be attentive with mindfulness to know what's going on in our experience, we begin to recognize that the experience of aversion itself in the moment is already unpleasant. It's already suffering, in effect. And so the mindfulness begins to reveal the momentary consequences of the aversion itself arising in the present moment. We feel the pain of it. We feel the suffering of having that feeling of aversion. And we see, actually, that if we act on that, it will condition more of that feeling, which the system, because the system essentially wants to move away from suffering, when we practice mindfulness, we begin to have different information than when we're not aware. When we're not so aware, we act on aversion, we get that moment of happiness, and we feel like, yes, that's the way. When we begin to practice mindfulness, we begin to see, well, I could do that immediate gratification thing and get rid of that. That's acting on aversion in this moment. Maybe let me delay the gratification. You know, so that it's essentially a little bit about the delayed gratification thing. We look at what does it mean to not act on what would head to the most immediate pleasant experience, in that case with an action based on aversion. Now, another piece around karma is that the actions that happen in the world, what we do in the world, can be motivated by so many different things. And so the same outward action from the appearances of people watching, it may be that I see something that is painful or threatening in my life, and I remove myself from that situation. That may happen out of aversion, or that may happen out of compassion and wisdom. And so that's the key point that the Buddha was pointing us to around our actions. That the action itself is not as important as the intention that lies behind the action. That when we act out of greed, aversion, delusion, we are cultivating more greed, aversion, delusion. When we act out of compassion, out of kindness, we are cultivating more of that. So the results of karma, not immediate necessarily. So I want to come back to the sense that karma is a natural law, like gravity or like genetics. Like if you plant a seed, a particular kind of tree grows, you know. We plant an apple seed and an apple tree will grow. We won't get an orange tree. This is a natural law. The growth of that apple tree depends on conditions. It depends on it landing in particular soil so that the seed has the capacity to become a tree. It has the capacity to become an apple tree. And yet it needs a lot of conditions to actually become an apple tree. The vast majority of apple seeds do not become apple trees. So that seed needs conditions of soil, of moisture, of light, of nourishment, of not being eaten by another animal or being mowed down. It needs a lot of conditions to actually grow. And then whether that tree lands in the crook of a rock or in soil may make it be a more stunted tree or a full tree. So there are so many conditions that are essentially outside of the capacity of that tree to become an apple, of that seed to become an apple tree. There's many outer conditions that impact that direction or what happens there. And so likewise with us, with our choices, you know, we have the choice to engage in making, so our choice, the direction of our choice may flower, or it may be more stunted, depending on the conditions in which that intention is landing. And so this comes to the exploration around, you know, what are the results of our actions? As I said, when we act out of greed, aversion, delusion, we tend to head in the direction of unpleasantness and suffering. We act out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, we tend to head in the direction of non-suffering towards freedom. But the results of acting out of a particular intention are not deterministic. So, you know, in the Buddha's day, he explicitly addressed this question of determinism, at least one of the forms of determinism that was around in his time. And that was, you know, the kind of understanding that if you make particular kinds of actions, you will experience certain kinds of results. So if you are, you know, in a simplest kind of way, we could frame this, if you are a murderer, you will go to hell. You know, that kind of idea of direct consequences, direct following from. So if you are a murderer, certain absolute destination will follow. So the Buddha did not say that. In fact, he explicitly said, if that was the way the world worked, there would be no room for the spiritual life. Because essentially, whatever our actions have been in the past, we get to live out those consequences. What he said instead is that when we make an action, it tends in a direction. It moves in a direction. That direction is influenced by many things, much as that seed. The capacity of that seed to grow into a tree is influenced by many things. Those many things that influence it are the conditions that are leading up to that moment, and the conditions in this moment, and our future actions. So, for instance, if you know, there's an analogy the Buddha offers around this. You know, the consequences, he said, for some, a certain action with a motivation based on greed, aversion, delusion will lead to a lot of suffering and pain. For another person, that very same action based on that same intention will be almost unnoticed. There will be a consequence. There will be an unpleasant result, but it may be barely registered. So he uses this analogy about taking a tablespoon of salt and putting it in a glass of water. If you put a tablespoon of salt into a glass of water, where that tablespoon of salt is said to be the action and the intention of the moment, and the glass of water is said to be the conditions in which that's arising in our minds. So the glass of water is like our minds. If we take a tablespoon of salt and put it in a glass of water, that glass of water becomes polluted. We cannot drink that glass of water. However, if we take that same tablespoon of salt and put it in a huge body of water, of pure water, and take a glass of that water, you won't notice the salt, and it will still be drinkable. And so likewise, the Buddha described that the consequences of our intentional actions vary widely depending on what might be called the purity of our minds, or the conditions of our minds, of our hearts. If our hearts are constricted and tight all the time, actions out of greed and aversion and delusion are going to be felt much more strongly. If our hearts are open and spacious, when we act out of greed or aversion or delusion, we may feel it and, that hurt to do that, but we don't essentially end up experiencing long-lasting consequences, perhaps. There's a story in the suttas. And then our future actions, not only our present actions, but our future actions can impact the results of how our actions unfold. And so, you know, we may have a glass of water right now, and we dump a tablespoon of salt in it. And then as we move forward into our lives, it's like we're finding more and more fresh water to add to our system and not adding more salt. And so in our future actions, we can begin to dilute the consequences of that tablespoon of salt. So an analogy or a teaching in the suttas has to do with Angulimala, who was a mass murderer. He's said to have murdered 999 people in his life. And then he met the Buddha. And he wanted to murder the Buddha because he had a goal of murdering 1,000 people and creating a garland of their fingers. And so he met the Buddha, and the Buddha knew he was meeting this mass murderer and knew what he was coming up against, and gave some teachings to Angulimala and stopped Angulimala's mind. And in that moment, Angulimala recognized, I've been on the wrong path. This is not a direction that is helping me at all. And he changed. His mind stream changed, and he began to follow the teachings of the Buddha. It is said that he became fully awakened. He actually freed his mind completely. Now, so this teaching, I think, is in the suttas exactly around this karma teaching, because it points to, first of all, the possibility for a murderer to not go to hell. You know, this murderer became completely freed. And yet this murderer still had to experience the consequences of the karma of murdering. It wasn't on meeting the Buddha that suddenly he was, you know, happy all the time. I mean, I can only imagine, based on my own experience in meditation, when I've done something that's created harm, when I see in my meditation that has happened, there's a lot of purification and of pain that comes with that realization. And I can only imagine in Angulimala actually beginning to meditate and sit down and take the teachings of the Buddha, how much pain he went through as his mind relived all of those murders. And so he experienced the consequences of that karma in that reliving, in that process of purifying his mind. It's also understood that, you know, when he went on alms rounds, people knew who he was. They knew he was the person that had murdered 1,000 people or nearly 1,000 people. And as he walked through the village, they didn't give him alms. Instead, they threw things at him. You know, they'd throw sticks and stones and things like that. And he would come back with cuts and, you know, kind of bloodied and scraped. And the Buddha said, the Buddha's response was, "Bear it, Angulimala. You are experiencing the consequences of your karma now, for which you might have burned in hell for 1,000 years. There is a kind of an understanding of different hell realms and heaven realms in the Buddhist tradition. And so he pointed to the fact that Angulimala was receiving the consequences of his actions. But a few cuts and scrapes are vastly different than the long-term consequences of continuing on that path of murdering. And so in the moment when he stopped, he was like that glass of water with a tablespoon of salt in it. And in the following months, his actions expanded that glass of water, became larger and larger. So the consequences of having that tablespoon of salt in there became less and less. So this is some of the understanding around the consequences of karma. It's not fixed. It's not determined. It's not you do this, this happens. There are many conditions that can enter that allow us to alter the unfolding of that of those consequences. And so this is a... You know, this is, again, a specific kind of determinism that the Buddha refuted in his teachings. Now, another piece around the natural law of karma that occurred to me as I was thinking about this yesterday and comparing it to gravity, you know, this law of karma does, you know, it creates a kind of what we might call... conditioned will rather than completely free will, because our choices in this moment are conditioned based on what's happened. Even when we become mindful, even when we hear the teachings of the Buddha, our direction and choice of action is conditioned partly based on our nervous system, our sense of empathy with others is partly conditioned on that. Once we see one of the interesting pieces about being mindful and opening to what's going on in our experience is that once we see the way greed, aversion, and delusion lead to suffering, our system wants to move towards the other direction. And so that's condition two. There is an understanding. I think there's kind of an interesting, you know, thing on both sides of the question. You know, when we are not mindful, my sense is we don't have free will because we're just acting based on our past conditioning. When we become fully mindful, my understanding, the freedom of the Buddha, in some ways, in that complete freedom, the system chooses to not engage in actions that will cause harm. And so in a way, that's also not free will, but it is a kind of a natural expression of the law of karma and the law that happiness follows when we engage in wholesome action. Our system wants to move in that direction. And my understanding is that that's the natural movement of a mind that is free. Is that free will? I don't know. It is also conditioned. It is also conditioned based on our being. Our choices in the past, our decision to follow the teachings of the Buddha, our decision to look at our experience with mindfulness. It's conditioned in that direction. And yet, you know, if in the comparison of karma to a natural law, the apple seed produces an apple tree, not an orange tree. The law of karma, you know, if I hold this thing up and let go, it's going to fall. And this is a law of karma. I don't feel like I'm not free because I can't place this in air. It's just the law. I don't feel like that apple seed is not free because it cannot become an orange tree. It's the natural law. And likewise, the natural law of karma is this. These conditions. And so we learn to work within this natural law. We learn to understand it. And in our exploration of mindfulness, we learn to live in that law and learn what actions move us more towards freedom. There was one other thing I thought I wanted to say about this. Oh, right. Okay, so I talked about the two sides. The side when we're not mindful, acting on our conditions. We're just caught by our conditions and we're not free. And the side where we are fully awake and acting naturally, skillfully. And then there's the vast terrain in the middle where we're kind of in this in-between place of kind of sort of mindful, kind of sort of aware of our intentions and actions, sometimes aware, sometimes not, making skillful choices, sometimes not making skillful choices, other times noticing the consequences of our actions when we do make unskillful actions. We're in that terrain in the middle. And the feeling, this is a piece I wanted to point to, the feeling in that place in the middle often is that we have free choice. We can see in the middle. We can see, ooh, yeah, do I want to go that way? Maybe not. It feels like we have free will. I don't know whether we do or not, but we have choice in the moment, and our own system in the moment has an agency. It's not simply like a computer where you push the button from outside and things unfold. It's got its internal conditions that contribute to what's going on, and our inner processes in the moment are thinking about, are reflecting, oh, this is this direction. It's like our minds model and think, ooh, that direction, that's where that'll go. That direction, that's where that'll go. Which way do I want to go? And choice can be made. Sometimes that choice is more informed by our habits and our tendencies because we're not able, the mindfulness isn't quite strong enough. Sometimes that choice is more informed by our understanding of wisdom and compassion because there's more a capacity to see the consequences. And so it feels like there is free will. It feels like there is choice. In that moment, when it feels like you have a choice, if you can, make a skillful one. When it feels like there is that capacity to make a skillful choice, make a skillful one. It is conditioned, and yet if we, you know, one of the conditions around free will is if we think there isn't free will in that moment, if we think there isn't free will, that's a condition that is influencing our choices. If we think there isn't free will, it can at least become a kind of a passivity. It's like, oh, everything's just going to unfold the way it unfolds, and so why should I do anything? That would be a consequence of believing in determinism. if we believe that there's free will, we believe we can weigh choices. We can influence the unfolding of our lives. And so whether there is actually free will or not, behave as if there is when it feels like you have a choice. I don't know the answer. Certainly, philosophers for thousands of years have not been able to give the answer. And yet I do know that there is this capacity to choose, and choosing in a direction that is ethically skillful has dramatically changed my own life. So I left less time for questions than I'd hoped, but any comments, questions, thoughts about this topic? Yeah, go ahead. And let's use the mic. Would you pass the mic back to John? Thanks. I think it's not on yet.
I'm sorry, maybe I bored everybody with that. But I was kind of interested in that free will versus determinism. And I appreciate your answer. It was very thorough. And I especially appreciate the idea that the universe as a whole has free will, but the moment may be deterministic. What we do right now, you know, you're right, that's very, very useful to me.
In the moment, what I think is so interesting, actually, at least in the Buddhist understanding, in the moment, the moment is where we have the choice. And that's it in this moment. You know, that's our only place for choice. And so the more mindful we become, the more the capacity for choosing in a direction that leads to happiness. And yet again, that is it is conditioned. Whether we make that choice or not is conditioned. And yet, as I said, it feels like we have a choice. And so that too is a condition that creates the apple tree. It's like, you know, if we don't believe that we have free will, that apple tree grows in very stunted conditions. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah,
any other?
Yeah. Yesterday, I happened to reread a little piece by Thich Nhat Hanh on interbeing. And I'm wondering, and so throughout your talk, I've been thinking about what interbeing means. That is, that sense that we're all connected to everything else. In the universe, what does that have to do with free will or karma?
So I would point it back to that place where I talked about empathy, that there is a connection, the interbeing, that we don't live in isolation. And not only are we, you know, supported by the vast community out there. I mean, I was, you know, just the other day, I was just like, wow, you know, this world, for all of its troubles, you know, it's kind of amazing that 7 billion people on a planet can actually support each other. You know, I am supported by billions of people that I don't know in the creation of food, in the getting that food to the grocery store. I mean, it's like there's my ability to live depends on the not only other human beings, but the earth, the rain, the crops growing, etc. You know, so there's that form of interbeing. And then in terms of how it connects to karma, I think it is in relationship to that place where we have that empathetic response with people, so that when we see that our actions have an impact on someone else in their suffering or not suffering, when we feel into that consequence, that interbeing consequence, that our actions actually hurt others and that we hurt in return when we see that, that leads us in the direction of wanting to let go of those kinds of actions. So it's in this terrain of the feedback that we get when we are more mindful. It gives us new information, not just that we're this independent thing, but intimately connected with the rest of the world. Other comments?
You need the other mic. That one's gone red.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know how much this matters, or if it even does, but you said the cup of water and the salt, and that some people have a lot of unskillful actions that have hurt a lot of others, and that, like, their cup would be smaller. And in a way, it seems to me like people who do that habitually, that it doesn't seem to affect them much. It's kind of just like that's the way it is for them, and life goes on.
That's where the understanding about the consequences not necessarily being immediate comes in. That because, I mean, in a sense, you know, they may not be consciously feeling the consequences of those actions. Like Angulimala, you know, for years he was a murderer. And feeling like that's the way, you know. And so for years he didn't experience directly the consequences until he started really paying attention. So the consequences are waiting to be felt, essentially. And when that happens, the Buddhist understanding of, you know, those consequences may be felt later in this life, they may be felt at death, they may be felt in a future life. So there are, you know, that the natural law of karma is understood to not only be in this life but future lives, and that the consequences may not happen in this life. So that's it's not about kind of like a moral, like, judgment thing. It's more just the natural law again. So yeah, I mean, this is a big question, and one that came up in the time of the Buddha too. You know, so why do people behaving that way seem to be happy? You know, what's going on? And you know, it's understood to have a longer term consequence.
Okay.
and for some of us that's easier to take than others, you know. But you know, in my own sense, you know, I don't know what happens at death, but I think there's a revisiting of our actions through life, and that how easy or hard it is to die may in somewhat be related to the size of that cup. We need to stop. So, thank you all.